All right, I just wanted to finish up a couple of things that I left unfinished. Let me just explain from the beginning, because we have some new folks here. Please come in, have a seat. My name is John Avery. I teach in Saudi Arabia as an English teacher at the University of Petroleum and Minerals on the Gulf side of Saudi Arabia, which is to say over here. It is the area where all the oil fields are, and it's also the area closest to Iraq, Iran, and all of the conflict over there. Although we, I'm pleased to say, do not feel any of that at all in our day-to-day life. Saudi Arabia seems a fairly stable and safe place for us, and I wouldn't stay if it wasn't, especially to keep a family and children there. We've talked over the week about views of Islam, about Muhammad the Prophet, about the basic beliefs of Islam. And today I wanted to, today is more of a history lesson, to look at, first of all, what they call Sharia, which is their code of conduct or social responsibility, and then to look at what's happened to the Islamic world since Muhammad and the expansion of that world, which brings us right up to front page history, front page headlines of what's going on in Lebanon, what's going on between Iran and Iraq, and how the events and the religious history of the past have affected, made a serious contribution to modern history. All right. The Quran, we've noted, is the holy book of Islam. It was given totally to Muhammad. He claimed to be the receiver of the revelation from God, and the book is written entirely from these revelations. The Quran, the word Quran itself means recitation. He never actually wrote it down himself. In fact, it said that he was illiterate and incapable of writing it down, and therefore he must have received it from God. That's the Islamic view. The other important thing in Islam is called the Hadith, which means the sayings and actions of the Prophet Muhammad. In a lot of ways, Islam is very much a personality following. I hesitate to say cult, because it's not a cult in the sense of that we've known as cults, whatever Muhammad did was taken as being higher than what anybody else could have done. He wasn't seen as a divine being at all, and Muslims are very seriously dedicated to that idea, because the main precept in their theology is that there is only one God. There is no son of God. There is no spirit of God dividing up the Godhead, but there is a single God, one authoritative, one holy, one merciful, one mighty, and one judgmental God. And to water that down in any way is to really to water down the essential Islam. So if you want a religion that is pure and direct and straightforward about who God is, at least in its most basic form, then that's what Islam offers. Now, this Quran and the Hadith come together to form what is called the Sharia. This is the law, or the way of life for Muslims. And for them, Islam is more than a religion. I believe a poll was taken one time, and take it for what it's worth, but they said that generally in America, one's religious belief did not seriously affect one's political belief in any kind of discernible way, or on broad patterns. But that certainly is not true in the Islamic world. Religion and politics are inseparable. They don't have the idea of the separation, the concept of the separation of church and state at all. There's no sense of render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and render unto God what is God's. Caesar and God are melted together. So that's why we have these regimes in the Middle East that are so what we would see as blatantly religious, using religion as a justification for their power. But they don't see it as a justification, they just see it as the appropriate way of operating. So the Sharia then is the righteous way, and it leads one in not only in religion, but it leads all areas, political, domestic, criminal. There are direct, rules about even the smallest things in life, how one washes and preparing for prayers. Some of the things get rather funny. Sometimes the concentration on the particular seems bizarre, for example, one person wrote into the newspaper, there's a column by a religious leader where he answers questions, and people seem to be concerned with what we would think of as petty things, like seeing the necktie as a form of the cross, and should Muslims wear the necktie as a form of, if it comes from Western Europe and meant to be a form of the cross. And he actually answered that quite well, that there was no historical basis for that at all, but that to me was just an example of how minute the concern can be for the smallest of things. But in a larger sense, the Quran or the Sharia divides all actions into five categories, and those I've put up here: required, encouraged, permissible, discouraged, and prohibited. Some are clearly required, like prayer. Five times a day, or the five pillars of Islam that I talked about yesterday, the prayer, giving alms, the holy month of Ramadan, the Hajj, and the fifth one escapes me. That would be going to... Maybe it was. We'll just say that it is. And some things are specifically prohibited. Pork, for example, eating pork, which comes from the Old Testament. Alcohol is strictly prohibited. And the largest category is the permissible. An example from one of my classes, or something that we come across a lot in teaching the students, is whether certain kinds of subjects are appropriate for the class. And one of these things is, we have, being English teachers, we buy materials from around the world, from worldwide publishers, and from England and America and so on. And one of these tapes was a listening tape. It was actually a mystery story, trying to get students to listen to a plot and to anticipate and so on. But part of the mystery story was some music that went along with it. Now, to some strict sects of Islam, music is prohibited. Any kind of music, any kind of embellishment at all in that way, is prohibited. But the leader of our program, Dr. Mullah, who got his PhD in the United States, said that clearly that music is in the middle category. It's permissible. It's not neither encouraged nor prohibited. The students who were being so strict were not within the mainstream, and therefore were allowed to play some music, but don't overdo it. For the most part, Sharia seems to be in terms of principles. It deals specifically with the areas which affected Muhammad. For example, infanticide was a practice that he spoke out against strongly at the time, particularly infanticide of girls. Or raiding of caravans, the tribes raiding one another. He set down rules or set behavior for that to happen or not happen. But of course it's silent on other things like euthanasia or water rights or genetic engineering, and it's up to the Islamic peoples now to decide on those kinds of issues. Okay. It It doesn't have to be narrow and restrictive, but it often is, especially in Saudi Arabia, the interpretation. Originally, the decision over what is acceptable and what isn't was to be left up to local groups or to the individual. But later, as the religion became institutionalized, it became the arena of the religious authorities. And as in many areas, this made it staid. And I think one of the results of that was the inability to for groups to think for themselves, for just to follow along in a pattern-like behavior without having to work out what is acceptable and what isn't. There are some revisionist movements within Islam to try to get away from that sort of strict following. But the tendency is generally to stick with the traditional. I explained one story, I'll just repeat it quickly. Abdulaziz was the first king of Saudi Arabia, and he wanted to introduce the radio into Saudi Arabia. But he had to find a coy way of doing this. So what he did was, the first time that it was used there, he read the Quran over it. So he argued that how can it be an instrument of the devil when in fact it's used to spread God's word. So there's the traditional, but trying to be spread, that the traditional would tend to clamp down on anything new. But in fact, Islam is not automatically against new technology. One of the big moves in Saudi Arabia is to bring, and they have done it in a tremendous way, is to bring in modern technology. The healthcare there is, I don't know if we can say it's equivalent to the United States in terms of its being on the cutting edge of new technology, but it's certainly, in terms of basic healthcare, it's certainly very adequate. My wife had a child there, for example. So, and she'll have another one, God willing, in October. So there are many ways that Saudi Arabia has entered very much into the 20th century, and it's been a tremendous change within a few short years. Okay, but the tendency for intolerance is sometimes very strong and sometimes quite irritating. Right, that kind of ends what I had on in terms of the social, religious perspective, and what I had to follow is something on the history. But is there any question about what I've just said? Because it's quite condensed. Otherwise, I'd like to just start on what happened in Islam after Muhammad died. Muhammad died in the year 632. And at the time of his death, Saudi Arabia had come together, not Saudi Arabia at that time, Arabia had come together and formed a political, religious, cohesive whole that it had never experienced before. It had been the kind of the far-flung concern of different empires, the Persians, the Byzantine Empire, which was a division of the Roman Empire, but it had never really been an empire or a country unto itself. But because of the religious cohesion and the cohesion of the language, Muhammad and his followers were able to bring together the Arabian Peninsula in a way that had not happened before. And there was a hot, red-hot dedication to this new faith, this new idea. And it caught the loyalty of that region, and it started to spread out. Now, as I've noted, that it was an advantageous time for them, because it was at a time when the Byzantine Empire and the Persian Empire, which were the two main powers in the region, had been exhausting one another with continual warfare. And there was a real void. And so it was ready, ripe, for another power to come in and to spread. And after Muhammad died, he had left no means of of choosing a successor to himself. And a successor and having one man in the context of those times was very important. But they did manage to choose a successor, and they gave the title of his office the caliph. Now, the caliph has been the traditional Islamic leader, not in the sense of being a pope. He's not a pope. He's a leader of temporal affairs, of military expansion of government. And there have been caliphs right from the time of Muhammad up into this century, and when the office of caliph was abolished in Turkey. They established this caliph, and they started expanding out of Arabia. And the first job was actually to bring or to give the tribes a sense of unity to the religion. They were dedicated to Muhammad as a person, as a personality, but not to the religion itself. So he had to rein them in militarily, governmentally. And then they started to spread out through the region. And I remember he died in 632, Muhammad, but by 636, they had pushed back the Persians or the Byzantines, whoever were in that region, and taken Damascus, which is now the capital of Syria. In 639, they had taken Cairo, or the region of Egypt. And Allah, God, indeed seemed to be on their side. They took it as a sign of God's will that they were able to expand their empire in such a dramatic way. People who had never done this before, people who had no military history, so to speak, who were merely warring tribes, who the only kind of military ability they had was raiding on from one tribe to another, of taking one tribe's camels or sheep, and kind of a novice military activity as compared to the vast armies that the other peoples had sent out. But they often overcame incredible odds and were able to establish their empire in different parts of the what we now know as the Middle East. When they did establish their empire in a certain area, they did not they occupied it but did not destroy it. They subdued but did not crush. They ruled and they tolerated. It's much like the Romans in Palestine during the time of Christ, is that they allowed the Pharisees and the existing structure to remain, while not trying to change that, but just to keep it under control. They exacted tribute for their empire and for further conquest. And all of this done was in the name of a word that has become familiar to us if we've been reading the papers, of holy jihad. Now, we know today the word holy jihad is the name of a terrorist organization or the name of people fighting against Westernism. But jihad has a larger sense, there's a larger sense of the word in Arabic, and it means fighting for one's faith, doing the right thing. And it doesn't necessarily mean military action. It can mean just prayers, or going to Mecca, or standing up for the faith, or writing a newspaper article. All of that in defense of the faith can be a part of jihad. So there is a large sense of jihad in the Islamic world, of what it means. But there was also, right from the beginning, given special sanction for and special favor to those who die for the faith. There's descriptions of paradise, of cool flowing streams, and a cool flowing stream in the Middle East is a precious commodity. and dark-eyed virgins, and you can imagine the attraction of that to the soldiers of Islam. And so the expansion of Islam continued, although there was division and disunity within it. One of the main reasons for disunity was that that of agreeing over who the successor to Muhammad should be. Now, they wanted the successor to be the person who was most capable. But Muhammad was married. In fact, he was married to nine wives at different times. And one of his daughters was married to a man named Ali, who also happened to be Muhammad's cousin. Now, Ali figures very prominently in Islamic history, especially in the history of the Shiites, a key figure. And
history of what?
The Shiites. The Shiites are the factional group that come from the followers of Ali. The followers of Ali thought that Ali himself had the best credentials to become the caliph, but for reasons of personal, he just wasn't the best man qualified for the job. To coalesce the different factions, to lead them in the expansion of the empire. So he was passed over three times. Well, finally, when the fourth turn came up, he was elected as the caliph, or the leader, the temporal head of the of Islam. But there was a lot of dissensions. His followers were bitter, the opposite factions were bitter, and his authority was challenged. And for the first time, Muslims started fighting Muslims. Up to this point, they had been a unified factor and expanded their empire. Now they were fighting one another. And in 661, he was assassinated. And the caliphate, which had always been where Muhammad had been in Medina, the city of Medina, moved from there up to Syria, Damascus. Which is, I haven't drawn in there, but it's above Iraq. It would complete a square of Israel, Jordan, Iraq, and Syria, just roughly, very roughly. So then this is the major change. And this is the division which separates the Sunnis from the Shiites. And this is the division that's remained the main division today. The Shiites are strong in countries like Iraq, Pakistan, and primarily, we all know, Iran. They're very different, very, very different theologically, personally, than the Sunnis. The Sunni religion is the orthodox religion of Islam, and it's actually 90% of Muslims. And this is not the fanatical fringe that we see operating in the Middle East, although there certainly are military movements within the Sunni group. But the real fanatical fringe tends to be with the Shiites, and it's very much wrapped up in their history, because after Ali died, his son Hussein tried to take over, and there was a battle between the Shiites and the Sunnis, in which Hussein was killed, his wives were killed, his sons were killed, and from that point, which happened, and that battle, which happened in the city of Karbala in Iraq, there was this division and hatred between the two groups. And today, there still exists this sense of martyrdom for the faith within Shiism, almost a thirst for martyrdom, to go the way of the leaders, to be martyred for the faith, and to enter into heavenly paradise by the process of martyrdom. And that seems to be the scary thing about the development of Shiism. Now, I'm not saying that all Shiites are like that, or that they've always been like that, but that's at least the present face that we see today in the face of Shiism that we have to deal with. So there was this then basic division between the two groups. Very quickly then, to finish the history of Islam, while Europe was going through the Dark Ages, and this is something we never learn in school, Arab civilization flourished in science and art and philosophy. All of the beautiful structures that with the domes and the beautiful calligraphy writing that we see today come from this period of vast expansion. Even the word algebra from the science of mathematics is an Arabic word. A lot of the early astronomers establishing the position of the spheres. And in fact, they had figured out a long time before Columbus that the Earth was round. All this happened in Islamic civilization. But there was a clash between then the Western civilization via the Crusades and Islamic civilization. And out of that clash, it was Western civilization which benefited the most. Because they were able to extract a lot of this learning and development of culture from Islam. Finally, the Mongols took over and in the region, and by the middle of the 13th century, the Arabs had slipped into an eclipse. The Caliphate continued in Cairo, but petty dynasties continued to work off one another until the establishment of the Ottoman Empire, which it was in modern-day Turkey, and that empire ended with the First World War. And then a part of that was the abolishment of the caliph and just doing away with the office of caliph. So the Islamic Empire flourished like a rocket, took off all these areas that had been contested between the Europeans and the Persians for centuries, established itself, burned brightly for a while, and then as an empire no longer continued to exist. There are still dreams of that happening again, of establishing an Islamic empire, an Islamic world. Okay. That is the main point I wanted to make today. There's just two other groups. I talked about the Shiites and the Sunnis, and how the Shiites came about being established. But there are a couple of other groups that are interesting in Islam that might just take a moment to look at, just because of the contrast they present. One group is called the Sufis. And the Sufis are the mystics of Islam. Quite an interesting group. The word Sufi comes from wool. And it's a wool-like garment, or a wool garment that would be worn by Muslim monks, very much like Christian monks. And they take their inspiration from mysticism and asceticism. And they were impelled towards a more intimate relationship with God. And it seemed to fulfill a real dryness, put some life and love into the dryness of typical authoritarian Islam. It was it gained some inspiration from Christianity and from other religions, and it's had an impact on the mainstream of Islam, although it also became a point of reaction against modern Orthodox Islam, as is carried out in Saudi Arabia. It seemed to humanize the Orthodox faith. It filled a kind of spiritual need. It was, interestingly enough, the ruler of Libya until 1969, until Muammar Gaddafi overthrew him, was a Sufi, and it was a Sufi country, Libya. This aspect of Islam is based on love and more compassion than traditionally known. But it's always been a minority, and it's not really pure Islam in any sense. It's closer to the religion of the Orthodox common people than Orthodox Islam. The other group that I deal with, because I live in Saudi Arabia, is the Wahhabism. Now, Wahhabism, the development of that is coterminous with the development of the history of Saudi Arabia. Wahhab was a legal scholar born in Central Arabia in the middle of the 18th century, or the beginning of the 18th century, 1703. And he saw all this mysticism going on, the folk religions, and he wanted basically a back-to-the-basics movement of Islam. He wanted man, God, Muhammad, and the Quran, and that's it. Instead of all of this medieval theological thinking which had gotten to the religion, putting the power of interpretation and determining religious life in the hands of a few, he wanted to get back to the basics, kind of, in a sense, of Martin Luther, a real reformer wanting to get back to pure Islam. Of course, his goal was a different. The goal of the religion that he wanted to get back to was very different. But in sense of wanting a basic, back to the basics movement, it's very much like that. The area from Mecca up to Syria. But this this movement was put down at the beginning of the 19th century, in 1811. But the spirit remained. And these people remained in the central area, the driest part, one of the driest parts of the world. I said yesterday how the purity of the desert is kind of like the purity of Islam. It's dry, it's clean, it's arid, it deals only with the essentials. And that's how I see the Wahhabism in its purest form. And they struggled with the rulers of the Hejaz. Now, the Hejaz is the area that Mecca and Medina are in, and it's always been a powerful area because those two cities are there, and they are the holy cities of Islam, two of the holy cities. So the rulers of that area have always had a lot of traditional power. And they were able to throw out the Al-Saud family into Kuwait. But in 1902, Abdulaziz ibn Saud came back from Kuwait, took over Riyadh, which is now the capital of Saudi Arabia, and eventually won control over the country by the mid-1930s. And thus we have the name Saudi Arabia. So the strict Wahhabism sect then became the mainstream. It got it away from the, what one author said, the Turkish vanities, the superfluous medieval structure that had slipped into the religion, and a lot of what came from the Sufis. Now Wahhabism seems to be in the mainstream of Sunni Islam, not a side group. It was not a reform movement. It was a reform movement within, not a deviation from pure Islam. It wasn't something coming from outside. Now, there are other side groups like the Druze in Lebanon or the Alawites in Syria, but the main groups then are the that I'd like to leave in your mind are the Sunnis and the Shiites. And that's how the balance of power still is today. The Iranians, out of their Shiite history and background, are trying to establish a holy Islamic state throughout the region. Ayatollah Khomeini and his followers recognize no modern constructs like countries' boundaries. They see their requirement is to spread their religion, especially Shiite religion, to the region of Iraq specifically, because that's where the main shrines, one of the reasons is Karbala is there, one of the main shrines of the Shia religion, where Hussein was martyred. And they would love to spread it to other regions and, in fact, get involved in this in Lebanon and other areas. And in a lot of ways, it's very difficult to follow. The Shiites and the Sunnis and the Christians and the Druze and all these groups are in Lebanon today. And Lebanon, unfortunately, for that tiny country, has become the as a hot point of all these factional groups. And they form alliances with one another and break those alliances and then break up into different alliances. It's almost impossible to follow. I know Lebanese people who can't keep up with all the different movements that happen. I don't know anybody who has any real hope for that region, for Lebanon itself. So that's the hot point. As to where Gaddafi comes from, which is a concern, I don't really know which group. I think he's within Sunni Islam, but he's really an entity unto himself. He's not to be seen within the framework of traditional Islam at all. He has his own little book and beliefs and his ideas of a modern state mixed in with a lot of Western readings and philosophy interpreted in odd ways that make him really a kind of a power and a person unto himself. He's not accepted, not liked by the rest of the Arab world. After the bombing on Libya, the Arabs wanted to have a summit. This was in the news. I mean, I'm repeating what you already know. But I think that because nobody really supports him, they couldn't agree where to have the summit or what to have the summit on, so the summit never really took place. It was supposed to be in Morocco, and at the last minute it was called off. So he's kind of isolated. He's not been good in terms of oil pricing policy. He's been way out on the fringes in that. Wanting to shoot up the price of oil as much as possible throughout the whole history of OPEC. He's a member of OPEC, whereas the Saudis have wanted to maintain a stable, low price, keeping oil as a viable fuel. Gaddafi really shouldn't be seen as part of the mainstream of Islam and development that way. That's about the time. I'm sorry I talked the whole time. I didn't really mean to. but there was a lot of... I wanted to finish the notes.
Are there any particular theological differences or sociological differences between those two main bodies, or is it a matter of political?
Oh, there's a lot of theological differences. Shiite Islam is much more into a mystical... belief into this heredity. It seems to center around the idea of the Imam, the one leader coming back and being a leader for his people. Whereas that kind of leader worship is rejected within Sunni, within pure Orthodox Islam. Within the Sunni.
It's in the Sunni.
No, it's within the Shiites.
Okay,
all
right.
Yeah. It's rejected. Oh, maybe I used the wrong word. Rejected by the Sunnis. Yeah. Any other questions? It's a lot to swallow within an hour. Yeah.
Hey, I know you mentioned the Shiite and the Sunni. What about the Druze Muslims? Where the Sunni came from?
The Druze are... a particularly mysterious group. They're a minority. And the only reason I think that they've come into our knowledge at all in the West is because they have a separate militia in Lebanon. And they're kind of a power force there. For some reason, Lebanon has seemed to be the place where a lot of these groups have settled, which is really a shame that they've all come to be so against one another, because most of the Lebanese people I've met are really wonderful people. But the Druze, the reason I'm kind of skipping around exactly what they're based on is because the source that I read in preparing for this said it's not really known what they believe, that they're kind of a combination, and a lot of things working together, and they have secret rights that nobody, that very few of the elites are able to have privilege to. So I think they should just basically be seen as a very small minority group within Islam. The book that I've used primarily in preparing for this, I've used other things, but this, and it's supposed to be coming into the bookstore. I've checked recently, it's not there yet. It's called Understanding Islam. It's thin, it's inexpensive, and it's interesting.
Why did this happen to Lebanon so much? Why is all of these groups
I don't know why they happen to reside there. I know that the basic destabilizing factor in Lebanon is, well, first of all, it came out of the colonialism of the region. All of these areas were divided up between the English and the French at the end of the First World War. Winston Churchill sat down in Cairo with a map and said, we will occupy Palestine. The Hussein family will be established in Iraq and Jordan, and they're still the king of Jordan, although the king of Iraq was overthrown by the present ruler. And out of that colonialist breaking up, and France had control of Syria and Lebanon, these were kind of artificial divisions, as colonial powers are wont to do, to kind of set up political groups. And a constitution was drawn up in Lebanon, whereas I think it was the presidency was left in the hands of the Christians constitutionally, and the prime minister had to be a Muslim. And that constitution held for a long while until 1975, when the power groups are no longer in alignment. The reality of the groups are no longer, the size weren't in alignment with the power attributed to them in the constitution. And a civil war broke out to try to change that. Since then, it's also been a place where a lot of Palestinian refugees coming out of Israel have ended up being pushed into. See, the policy in Israel of pushing out the Palestinians has pushed them into areas that has destabilized the rest of the Middle East. And for as much sympathy that's been expressed in the Arab world for these Palestinian refugees, one of the main reasons they're expressing sympathy is because these groups come in and they're a disenfranchised people, and they tend to destabilize the countries that they end up in. And that was one of the reasons that, well, it was the main reason that Israel went in, and what was it, 82, into Lebanon, was to drive out the Palestinians. And the reasons behind Lebanon are so, and why it's such a mess, are so complex, but it has to do with all of these different groups, these different power groups residing in one small territory and struggling for it. And it's really a shame, because it was one of the most advanced countries in the Middle East. Beirut was known as the Paris of the Middle East, a beautiful city. Right on the Mediterranean, and it developed economically quite well. But now, it's hard to know who's in control or what's going on there. Syria has a vested interest. Hafez Assad, the president of Syria, wants to see his authority extended over into that region. Israel has a security interest in Lebanon, doesn't want the PLO to come back in and threaten its northern territory. So it's really quite a mess. I don't know if that answers your question, but it kind of talks around it. Yeah, any? Yeah.
I have not a member of my congregation, but he comes regularly because he's living with somebody else who is a Sufi.
Uh-huh.
And there's a Sufi monastery in New Mexico, just south of Albuquerque in the mountains. And there's also a Shiite monastery near Christ in the Desert Monastery, which is a Benedictine monastery out in the desert. But in talking with this Sufi, I've always had the impression The guy had just fallen somewhere. I know little things that come out of Sufism. That's your understanding.
It's one of the more interesting areas of Islam, I think, because of this mysticism that gets away from the dry rules and regulations of the mainstream. I don't really know that much about Sufis because they're not in Saudi Arabia, and so we don't encounter them or hear them talk. But I have a feeling that they have developed along that mystic area tradition, very much so, and I'm not surprised that they have a monastery there. No, Ataturk. Ataturk was the George Washington of Turkey. He established a pretty incredible man. Within his lifetime, he had changed the Turkish language, brought in Western habits and ways, and tried to bring Turkey into the 20th century, which is seen from a couple of different directions. One is from the traditionalists, it seems like he was a traitor to the traditional Turkey, and from those who want to develop Turkey, it seems like a modern hero. But one of the things that he did was he realized that how destabilizing this caliphate was, I think, and with allegiance to the church rather than to the state, and he wanted to establish a secular state. So the caliphate was abolished. I think so, but I know that he had a lot of sympathy for the ways of the West. For example, he used to go to rallies in Turkey, and he would wear a Homburg, a German hat, and he'd point at different people in the crowd and say, "You're wearing a fez. Look at you, you're stupid, you're backwards, you're wearing a fez. Take off that hat. Wear a modern hat like me." Just quite an astonishing man. And he's the one who banned the veil in Turkey. So making a lot of these changes from the traditional ways has, you know, you feel ambivalent about it. One of the things that he did was he changed the Turkish, as I said, the language, so that a lot of ancient, not even ancient, but older Turkish literature is inaccessible to modern Turks, because now they have a Western alphabet. So they can't even read the alphabet that the old Turkish literature was written in, and it has to be translated.
John?
Yeah.
When the caliphate was abolished, what was to prevent the caliph or somebody who wanted to be the caliph from establishing the same office in some other country?
I suppose there wouldn't have been uniform support for that. I'm not really sure. That's a good question. In fact, when it was abolished, the man who was Abdulaziz's enemy in Saudi Arabia, or in Arabia at the time, designated himself as caliph because he was the protector of Mecca and Medina. Now, that was seen as raw power grabbing and laughable by the Islamic world, and probably because of that, one of the reasons the caliph wasn't picked up then was because he just wasn't accepted.
From the religious point of view, this fellow in Turkey was recognized by Islam in general as being.
I don't know if one would have to study the Ottoman Empire, but
yeah.
The Ottoman Empire was an empire that. Of course, the Turks were Muslims, and they maintained Islam through their empire. I think it was pretty much a honorific position by that time, and that's probably why, maintaining no power, he was able to abolish it.
Yeah, it sounds like it wasn't such a big deal, I guess.
Right,
everybody,
by that time.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Do you think that
They don't separate the two.
I know, but I'm asking in your mind.
Yeah. Well, see, this is how Saudi Arabia has been established and maintained. That, yeah, please, if people, I'm long gone over the time, so if you want to catch some sunshine for today, please feel free to go. But the leader, Abdulaziz, realized that he had to gain the support of the strict Wahhabi leaders in Central Arabia, and he not only gained their support, but he used their religious energy to fight against all the other powers in the region and to unify the tribes. And to this day, that I think that's essential to the Saudi government, is that people stay as Muslims, because if they do, then he's got a firm grip on their behavior, the king does. And in one sense, it truly is the opiate of the people. It really maintains, religion maintains power control. And it certainly must be in Iran, where families are sending their children in droves to the front as 12-year-old boys and younger, going just without any training, leaving on buses, showing up at the front, being sent in human suicidal waves against the machinery of Iraq and being mowed down. It's just got to be an opiate, because people, who in their right mind would allow this to happen to their children? Of course, that's the way we see it. They see it as that human life isn't so precious, and that to fight for one's religion is a stronger and holier and better purpose.
John, you've actually got a couple minutes still.
Oh, do I?
Your watch must be off from home and life.
Oh, okay. Any other questions?
I wonder if you've got any thoughts on the little that I've read on Islam. I read because I got interested in what in the world the black Muslims meant in the United States as I worked around black communities and cities. And
did you find out?
Well, I it's a question I'm still fascinated by. I just wonder whether you have any.
I don't know a lot about black Muslims.
So far as we hear about,
I saw that it seems like they were using Islam as a means for a power base and a way of rejecting white Christianity, the white white culture. Is that the way you've seen it?
Well, that's certainly part of it, although there's an awful lot of the kind of very tight and conservative discipline that you've described as key, particularly to mainstream Islam.
That's really good for maintaining control of troops. And
well, that's right. And it's very, it appeals to the poorest communities in the city. It flourishes in prison, and once folk get into it, they are really highly disciplined in a way that stands out markedly from other influences in black communities in the United States. So it's a sort of alternative to prison life, but created and self-adapted way of expressing
I know within
humanity.
Yeah,
you know?
I know within Islam at all, it's not a racist religion at all. You know, limited or to one race. The racial groups that Islam embraces is really incredible, all the way from the Berbers in Morocco and Algeria to the Islanders in Indonesia, Malaysia, the world is very expensive, and you know, into China. So, in terms of being black Muslims, that must be a development within this country.
There are certainly variations within the black Muslims on how they think about race, whether they're exclusive about it or not.
In fact, I thought I'd heard that the founder the movement had died, that they were becoming less racially defined.
Certainly the largest group of the Muslims.
They're trying to evangelize with Islam as a whole. I know that they're not known about or understood that much in Saudi Arabia.
Is there much Christian missionary work going on there, and what's the response to that?
There's none in Saudi Arabia.
Really?
Yeah, it's absolutely illegal. In other Arab countries there is. In fact, Christians were there long before they came to this. I mean, that's the Middle East. That's where we started this. So in Jordan, Syria, I mean, Syria and Jordan in Muhammad's time were Christian areas. And that's where he picked up a lot of the information that was later to come into the Quran.
In the communism program?
Communism. Well, this is one reason why Saudi Arabia maintains such strong relations with America, is because they see us as anti-communist. And communism, of course, there is no religion, the pure communism. They are strongly opposed to that. They maintain no diplomatic ties with Russia. But Russia does have its relations with countries like Syria and Libya. It was very strong in Egypt until Sadat threw them out. You know, they built the Aswan Dam, which is the main power source in that country. And after that, Nasser died, then Sadat came in, found out that he didn't have, he needed to get rid of them to establish the kind of power that he wanted to. It's not a real fruitful area for Russia. I know that Iran is just as much against Russia as they are against America. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My watch was a